Court's on the record, clause number 2016-4248, United States Anti-Doping Agency, as a rule, sort of two petition level, is it just itself on the record?
Chad Arnett, which petitioner do you side?
I'm sorry, who was that, sir?
Chad Arnett, which petitioner do you side?
Thank you, sir.
And Bill Bott, who you side as well.
John Bain for respondent, Dr. Jeffrey Brown.
Bruce Bain.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir.
So this is a continuation of our previous hearing. Some additional pleadings were filed. Mr. Arnett, since the court discussed its concerns with you last time, I'll let you follow up and kind of see if there's anything else that you want to bring to the court's attention or if you want to highlight.
Yes, Your Honor. And before I do so, are there any particular areas you would like us to address? My opposing counsel has filed, I think, now four briefs and some additional objections, raising a number of issues. We filed one brief, the one that you authorized us to file Wednesday night. Is there anything in that you'd like us to address?
Well, there's this issue of subject matter jurisdiction. Sort of the alternative position they maintain or represent that you maintain in other cases when this issue has been brought up by the other side. They've cited these positions as well as Mr. Bach.
Mr. Bach.
Mm-hmm. I guess his position on subject matter jurisdiction and arbitration. And I forget if it was a publication or if it was in other cases as well. And so, sort of belie your contentions in this case. I don't know if you want to address them now.
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly we do. And what I'd like to do, if it pleases the court, is start with some commentary on the rule itself and then allow Mr. Bach to mention, make some specific comments to the court about the Sports Act itself, since they've raised an issue with respect to that statute. Rule 202 says, in the cases that have addressed jurisdiction at all with respect to Rule 202, principally the In Re Doe case from the Supreme Court, hold, and the rule states that a 202 proceeding must be filed in a proper court. That's straight from the statute. You've got to file a verified petition in a proper court. The only case without the Supreme Court dealing with jurisdiction was a case that was filed because the party anticipated litigation. Of course, that's not why we filed this proceeding. We filed it under the other prong. But the In Re Doe case involved a party who anticipated litigation against a blogger, an anonymous blogger, who was making allegedly defamatory statements about a Houston businessman. Jurisdiction came up in that case. And here's why it came up. Came up because the court, following Rule 202, said when you file a Rule 202 case, it must be filed, and I'm reading from 202.2b, in a proper court of any county. Where venue of the, and here is the definition of which is the proper court, where venue of the anticipated suit may lie when suit is anticipated. So if suit is anticipated, which was the In Re Doe case, you must file it in a court where the anticipated case would be filed. In that case, the potential defendants were out of state. They actually never revealed who they were. They filed as John Doe's. But the court said, well, it says you got to file it in the appropriate court where you would actually sue if you proceed. And this isn't the proper court. These people aren't even in Texas. Where suit is not yet anticipated, which is exactly what we have here, where you're investigating potential claims, the proper court, according to 202, is where the witness resides if no suit is yet anticipated. That's exactly this court, because Dr. Brown is here. He lives in Harris County. He practices medicine here. The facts are that he treated some of these athletes here. So we feel like that we have satisfied the rule to the letter. And certainly there is no court decision that we've seen that says where you're investigating a suit, there's some other standard that applies other than what the rule says. So we feel like there's no trooper issue here at all. We feel like we fully satisfy the rule. This is not trooper because we have an anticipated suit. We're merely investigating. And I know they've raised some comments on the Ted Stevens Act. We don't think those control either, as Mr. Bach will address.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. In terms of the arbitration issues, I obviously strongly disagree with the idea that we've taken inconsistent positions. And so it'll take a little bit of explanation because there's been, unfortunately, some very strong claims that are not accurate. And so hopefully I can get those addressed. But I'll start with the premise that it's accepted around the country that arbitration is very well used and to be encouraged. And state and federal courts around the country alike encourage arbitration. And so the real question here is whether in adopting the provision that allows Rule 202 to be used pre-claim or pre-suit, the Texas legislature intended to remove arbitration, which is a very well-used dispute resolution process, entirely from the ambit of Rule 202. We don't believe that that's the case.
When you say legislature, I don't know if 202 is a statutory. It's an equitable, and I don't remember the predecessor. It's a discovery. It's a pre-suit discovery rule that sounds inequitable.
You're right. Absolutely, inequity and to promote efficiency and the wise use of resources by parties, by the courts, by the entire system.
Right, and they're not intended for routine use, right? This is not a favored way to conduct discovery in Texas.
Well, I think it is a method to conduct discovery when you're trying to determine whether you might have a claim or suit, and that's precisely the portion of the rule that we're moving under, and it must have been intended for use.
Well, I guess the concern is that the rules, you need to have actual legal basis for the lawsuit, right? And so this is a method to allow you to investigate your claim so that you can, in good faith, file a lawsuit in the state of Texas when you may not otherwise feel that you have the facts that would justify filing a lawsuit. And so, equitably, this is a way to kind of get those facts.
Suit or claim. And our contention is that it's broader than just a lawsuit, that it involves any claim, which includes potentially claims in arbitration. And so, what I think has happened here is that Dr. Brown and his counsel have conflated two important and distinct concepts. One is the investigation of a claim, and the other is the dispute resolution process used to resolve the claim. So we're here in the investigation phase, and arbitration has nothing to do with our investigation of potential claims. The dispute resolution process, which is all that the Sports Act talks about, is the resolution of disputes, is a distinct situation. And arbitration does not apply to that. That is why when they take an article that I wrote when I gave a talk to the American Bar Association talking about dispute resolution in the Olympic context and said that arbitration is the exclusive means of dispute resolution, that's exactly the case. And that's what the Sports Act says. But we're not here about dispute resolution. We're here about investigation of the claim. And so, if I could, Your Honor, give you just a copy of the one provision in the Sports Act that really addresses arbitration related to eligibility issues. And that's this section 220509. Interestingly, if you go through all of the briefs that have been filed, Mr. Arnett said that there are four. I've read, I'm not sure that I saw the last one that was filed, but the ones that I've read so far haven't included anything other than a reference to the Sports Act, as if it's some talisman that eradicates jurisdiction. But if you look at the language of the rule, it's very specific, and it talks about dispute resolution. It says the corporation, meaning the U.S. Olympic Committee, shall maintain provisions in its constitution and bylaws for swift and equitable resolution of disputes. So these are disputes, and then it says, involving any of its members and relating to the opportunity of an amateur athlete, coach, trainer, administrator, manager, or official to participate. So these are disputes related to a very specific thing, participation in the Olympic Games and other protected competition. It doesn't, in our opinion, have anything to do or relate to investigations. So, secondly, the Sports Act cases, I think, and we gave you, or we referenced the Lee case, and I brought a copy of that case. This is a Sports Act decision where the U.S. Olympic Committee and the Taekwondo Union took the position that the Sports Act precluded all other sorts of claims, such as Title IX claims and other claims of discrimination. And what the judge in that case said is, no, the Sports Act applies to eligibility decisions and requires their arbitration, but it doesn't preclude the whole scope of other statutes and other legal provisions. And citing the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Morton versus Mancari, the Leap case or court said, when two statutes are capable of coexistence, it is the duty of the courts to regard each as effective. And that's the situation here. The Sports Act exists and is effective, but it relates to a specific area, and that is the resolution of disputes. This provision that we're moving under relates to the investigation of potential claims. Those are two separate and distinct concepts, and that's why we believe that Texas Rule 202 permits us to take a pre-claim deposition of Dr. Brown. Now, going on to address, as you said in your question to Mr. Arnett, hasn't Mr. Bach taken positions that elsewhere that belie the claims made here? And I wanted to go on and address some of the other claims made by Ms. Bain. She uses the term false, knowingly false, or materially false 9 times in her brief about me and about the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. Now, if you analyze it, those relate only to 3 factual areas, and I'll address those real quickly. First, she claims that somehow we made a false statement because we didn't tender releases to Dr. Brown prior to June of 2016. And that's not true, and I have the releases here.
And I don't know if it's necessary to go through all those issues, but you know, the case you handed me, the Amateur Sports Act grants the USOC exclusive jurisdiction over all matters pertaining to United States participation in Olympic Games. And so, discrimination on the basis of the race in violation of Section 1981 does not pertain to the United States participation in Olympic Games any more than the legal dispute that the court earlier hypothesized. For the same reason the USOC may sue, be sued in connection with hypothetical lease dispute, the USOC and USTU may be sued for alleged race discrimination. So there's, I don't think there's any question that, you know, that you can have a dispute with somebody, you can get a car accident and sue somebody for negligence and pay for it. That the Amateur Sports Act wouldn't, if it involved this organization, Amateur Sports Act wouldn't trump, right? But if you're going to talk about issues that are within the ambit of that statute, that's a different thing, right? That's what we're here to investigate those claims. We're not investigating a lease dispute.
Usually, you said within the ambit of the Sports Act. It simply is not within the ambit of the Sports Act. The Sports Act relates to eligibility disputes. And the primary reason is that those disputes should be, particularly when you're on the eve of the Olympic Games, just like the statute talks about, there is a strong interest in having those disputes resolved internally within the arbitration process. This is pre-claim. There's no, Dr. Brown's not going to the Olympic Games. He is a longtime member of USA Track and Field for many years. He's a member of USA Track and Field. This is a question of our investigation of whether he violated sport rules. And so that, in our view, is not within the ambit of the Sports Act, what the Sports Act was intended to do. It was not, we are...
You would go to arbitration for those violations you're talking about because the Sports Act sends you to go to arbitration, right?
Yes, sir. We would.
So how is it not within the ambit?
Because we are at the investigative phase. We have not brought a claim. And so we're not in arbitration. There are no arbitrators, and there is no reason that we can't use a state provision that allows for us to determine whether or not we should go to arbitration.
Right. Rule 202 is not a tool to go and just help somebody to see just a fishing expedition, right?
So of course it's not a fishing expedition. That's why we're here. We've offered to present evidence about the extent of our investigation. That's why we brought you the records to show you how illegible they are. That's why we brought you the releases from 7 athletes that say we want our records to be discussed with USADA by Dr. Brown.
Right, but all those potential claims fall within the USOC, the Amateur Sports Act, right?
They do not fall within the Sports Act. They are, what we are seeking to do right now is to investigate whether or not we have a claim. We have agreed, and Dr. Brown has agreed. You only care about those violations. I'm sorry?
You only care about those violations, right? I mean, violations of doping, and you're not here to investigate anything else, really, are you?
That's a broad question.
With his
Are there other things that we could do? Yes, there are other things we could do. We could refer information that we have out to other organizations. We are not limited simply to finding anti-doping rule violations. If we find violations of other laws or statutes, we can provide that information. So that the only thing we do is not simply bring
arbitration. Right, and I understand that.
Okay.
This is 202 to investigate a potential claim, right? Not any claim in the world, but a potential claim. I mean,
yes.
You have to be able to say, this is the potential claim,
right?
You have to be able to at least, this is the possible claim that we're pursuing.
Right, and the potential claim that we're pursuing is Dr. Brown's potential violation of anti-doping rules. And we have agreed, and he has agreed, that the ultimate resolution of that case would be an arbitration if he doesn't accept our proposed sanction. So that would be the ultimate endgame, and I completely agree with that. But I believe that process or that part of it is completely separate, distinct from the investigative phase of the case. And the Sports Act applies, let me put it this way, arbitration is not a good or investigative tool whatsoever. You don't initiate an arbitration to figure out what happened. And so that, the idea...
And I think you made that, and actually, that's a fair point. Arbitration is, and especially this one, right? Because they don't allow you to call witnesses or subpoena you can't force the respondent to actually testify.
Well, see, that's another thing that is entirely inaccurate in what was filed in front of you, Your Honor. They cited one case, and I brought with me a subpoena issued by an arbitration panel to Mark Block, who was a respondent in a case. And
object to a subpoena in another case that we haven't even seen that has nothing to do with this case.
You made a claim. We made a false statement because.
Well, that's fine. You can address it. I just want you to finish what you
asked. Yeah. So in fact, Your Honor, and I'll bring you a copy of our rules, which allow arbitration panels to issue subpoenas. Number one. Number two, I'll bring you.
But the respondent itself, right? And you can't. Absolutely. I don't know if there's...
Absolutely inaccurate, Your Honor. We can subpoena the respondent, and he can be required to testify. And it happened in the case that I will give you where the judge was Judge Peter Lindberg, one of the three arbitrators, the chair of the panel. It was against Mark Block. The decision is on our website, and it was within a year of the decision that they cited. These are arbitrations. These are not court decisions that are matters of precedent. They are individual decisions by groups of arbitrators in a case, and they're not of precedential value. In one case, they said, we're not going to let you do this because there's this tool that also existed in the Block case of an adverse inference. They didn't allow it in that case. They have allowed it in the Block case. And then I also have... A Texas case where a witness was issued a subpoena. It was not the respondent in that case, but just to demonstrate to Your Honor that the Texas arbitration panels have allowed us to issue subpoenas to witnesses. So the claim that it was a false statement that we can't issue subpoenas of respondents in cases is inaccurate. In that one case, an arbitration panel did not allow or did not grant the subpoena. But in this case, the arbitration panel.
Okay. So did. And that's and I and we can and I understand you mentioned their imperfect tools, but this is the framework that you're operating under, right? Arbitration, whatever the rules are.
Your Honor, we have the responsibility to determine whether individuals involved in sport have abused the rules of sport, have abused individuals, have sullied and tainted sport, and have made the playing field for international athletics unlevel. That is our responsibility.
I don't have an issue with your mandate or charge,
sure,
or any issue with the way that's carried out. And I understand there's disagreement between parties. That's obviously something that's beyond the scope of the court's ability to really have any informed opinion on. The only thing that I can do is under the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, make a determination and find whether or not you can take a recent demo.
Understood.
And whether that's actually something in these circumstances that's one even allowed based on the jurisdictional issues that they've raised or under the sort of considerations the court's supposed to take, which is whether or not you use Rule 202 in a way that makes an end run around you would otherwise have to live under, in particular because of arbitration. All this under, I think, a larger understanding of Rule 202 isn't something that's supposed to be used routinely. Courts are expected to scrutinize them because it's not within the framework of a lawsuit, right? There are due process considerations. It's just not, Rule 202 is not really meant to be a suit on its own. And there's you're not really told what the claims are against you.
No.
And so it's not really a completely fair process. And so because in a suit, you'd have a petition, there'd be claims against you, you know what the allegations are, what's relevant or not relevant.
Not pre-suit, Your Honor. Not pre-suit. And, Your
That's
Honor,
right.
In the Western District of Texas, Judge Sam Sparks held that the arbitration process affords a claimant constitutional due process. He accepted Lance Armstrong's arguments, which were inaccurate, but and decided whether or not we met the standard of constitutional due process. And our procedure does. Therefore, if there was a case.
Object. If he wants to cite a case, give me the cite, give me a copy of the case, give me something, but don't summarize what another judge has held without any reference to what he's talking about. I don't think that's appropriate.
Right, and so I'm not.
But you do.
I'm not using, when I say due process, I'm not using that in the capital P sense where this rule exists. You can obviously use it. But there's a concern in its application because it's not necessarily the best way to proceed with discovery. Because you don't have a petition, because what people ask you is not confined to the four corners of a petition where they're actually making claims and allegations against you, and you understand what you're being accused of.
Then your rationale eliminates the provision of the rule that allows pre-claim or pre-suit.
This is not my rationale. These are rationales that are moralized in plenty of courts and court of appeals opinions. That sort of, this is not something meant for routine use. It's an equitable rule, right? It gives you an opportunity so that you can investigate a claim before you actually file it. Because if you file it, there's expenses, there's costs associated with that, and you should, in some instances, you may not in good faith be able to file a claim because in truth, you don't have all the facts. And so, I'm just conveying I'm just letting you know the way the court interprets this rule based on what I've read. Is there anything else, counsel?
Your Honor, can I confer with
yes.
Counsel? Your Honor, can I defer to counsel?
Mr. Arnett, yes.
Okay. Your Honor, we'll reserve our remarks.
Okay. Can I? Why don't you get down to brass tacks? There's a lot of cases, mandamus cases, where a Rule 202 petition was issued, and there was concerns about the court abusing its discretion. Have you looked at cases where the opposite's true, where someone mandamus the court for abuse of discretion for denying Rule 202? Maybe those exist. I haven't looked for them. Generally, that's not the case where someone went to the court. I guess it would necessarily be a mandamus case. Maybe she would appeal, assuming it's a denial of the mandamus assistance.
I have not looked for that specific thing, but
have you
seen it, and I'm not sure that would actually even qualify for a mandamus proceeding because I don't think it would meet the standard.
Right, so it's like maybe on appeal, there's some sort of appellate review of a denial of a 202 petition where someone didn't get one and they said, hey, I was entitled to one. And the reason I bring that up is because I'm trying to figure out if there's some, if the Courts of Appeals have said, hey, you really need to take this into consideration. This is something that we, besides the issues that you've raised regarding subject matter jurisdiction and some of the other issues, but I just wanted to raise that point. That's not usually an issue that I'm concerned with, but I just wanted to throw that out there in case anyone had it.
I have not seen any. There are some cases discussing whether or not there is even appellate jurisdiction in the Rule 202 cases. And I don't think there is appellate jurisdiction for denial of a Rule 202 case. And I think in order to be entitled to mandamus, you have to meet the mandamus standard in Texas, which is also an extraordinary circumstance. So I will not represent to the court that there's not one somewhere out there in Texas jurisprudence, but I have not seen it. And
you have a hard time going to the Court of Appeals when you're denying a Rule 202 screening mandamus when there's no, you're not being ordered to do anything.
There's no absolute right to a Rule 202 petition. I mean, the only reason that you have the mandamus cases in situations where people are ordered to give a deposition is because the court finds they have no adequate remedy and that some right or violation has occurred by that exercise of discretion. So there is no absolute right to have a 202 petition. And I would like to, since I've given my opposing counsel plenty of time to argue, I'd like to address a few things before they jump in. They might have another case that I'm unaware of, but I have not seen one. In the In Re Casino case, which I discussed at length with you, I believe last week, it was a May 20th, 2016 Texas Supreme Court case. And it is a case under the second part of Rule 202, in other words, to investigate the claim. And if you look, I can't give you the page number, but it's on the first page of the printed version I gave you. It says, in this case, Rule 202 provides that a person may petition the court for an order authorizing the taking of a deposition on oral examination or written questions to investigate a potential claim or suit. And then it goes on. Such a petition must state the subject matter of the anticipated action, if any, and the petitioner's interest therein. It also held that a potential claim or suit must be right. Rightness is a threshold issue that implicates subject matter jurisdiction and emphasizes the need for a concrete injury for a justiciable claim to be presented. So I disagree with Mr. Arnett that there's not been any case law addressing jurisdiction in the context of the second prong of Rule 202, and I would offer the DePino case in that regard. I believe I also provided the court with the Hewlett-Packard case, in Re Hewlett-Packard, which is proceeding out of Austin in 2006. And that again.
Counsel, sorry to interrupt. When was this provided? Which pleading was this attached to?
It wasn't attached. I don't believe I attached it. I think I cited it. But I'll give you a copy just a second. But this is one of the cases I provided to the court last week. It also is an investigatory case. And if you look at the fact pattern in that case, it's very instructive here because the petitioner was seeking to see whether it had a claim and suspected that employees who left Dell were sharing trade secrets with Hewlett-Packard, and there's a lot of very instructive language in there. But in particular, on page 361 to 362 of the decision, it goes into great detail. Requiring an individual to sit for a deposition and disclose information to a former employer under oath as to why he or she left their employee to work for a competitor as well as exactly what the individual is doing for the competitor, particularly when no lawsuit has been filed, is a substantial burden. It is intrusive, expensive, and time-consuming. Add to that the complications in responding to questions designed to ferret out trade secret information of the individual's current employer, together with how such information might or might not have been affected by knowledge gained with a previous employer. And he goes on to say the balance is between the need for confidentiality versus the need to adjudicate existing disputes. The standard is not based on a potential litigant's desire to obtain confidential information, merely to evaluate suspected claims. If it were business entities, would have an extraordinary tool to obtain the trade secrets of their competitors. Now, granted, that's a trade secret case, but the analogies to this case are kind of obvious. We have the medical confidentiality issues. We have the fact that Dr. Brown is subject to confidentiality agreements in many of his consulting agreements, which we provided you an affidavit for. The burdens on Dr. Brown to put him in front of a videotaped deposition, which is what they've asked for, so that they can ask him questions which they know he can't answer, and then use that to go publish it in the press, just like this petition magically showed up in the New York Times with an allegation that Dr. Brown was ignoring the directives of his patients right after it was filed. That's just an improper use of Rule 202. It puts Dr. Brown in the impossible position of discussing studies and consulting situations where he's subject to confidentiality agreements and involve athletes. Excuse me, I did not interrupt you.
I'm going to object to counsel continuously, including in her filings and her arguments, arguing facts that are nowhere in the record. She continues to make accusations that are factual in nature. She doesn't have a witness here. She doesn't like her to put it on. This isn't in the record. She's arguing totally outside of the record. I think it's improper.
Actually, it is in the record. There's affidavits by Dr. Brown about the confidentiality agreement.
Okay. I think this is a continuation of our previous hearing. The court had conveyed its concerns previously to the petitioners. I think I saw the same concerns. I've looked at this, and I think the case is in Ray Hewlett-Packard, I think, makes the case, among others, about the issues and concerns we have in these kinds of cases. And based on all that, the court's going to deny the court's
judgment. Your Honor, if I may, just briefly, I understand that that's the court's desire. A couple of points of clarification. In connection with your ruling, is it fair to say that you're making it based on legal rulings? That is, that you think the Ted Stevens Act somehow precludes this proceeding?
Well, I think it's on a number. I mean, I have concerns about subject matter jurisdiction. I've granted rule go through petitions notwithstanding subject matter jurisdiction. State of Texas, there's a case in here where the state of Texas appealed mandating one of the cases and said that there are sovereign immunity, therefore ultimately they wouldn't be able to make a case against us. The problem is that wasn't the only claim that they were making in that case. I've had those issues. I think it's a large concern.
Yeah.
I think subject matter, based on what I've heard today, I think that's one of the issues in subject matter jurisdiction based on the case that you gave me. One second is arbitration. I think this is in a way an run around arbitration. The court also doesn't believe that you have the rule to ensure requirements of findings, which is the burden outweighs the benefit outweighs the burden.
And Your Honor, in connection with that ruling, am I correct that the court will not allow us to put on evidentiary testimony?
Correct. So I think the court in general bases its decision on pleadings. Assuming everything you say is true, I'll take everything you say is true. In your petition, whether or not the court believes that you met the requirements are in 202, I still wouldn't report it. So.
Okay, but Your Honor, you do recall that in the first hearing we all tried to put on a witness and you wouldn't allow us to do that.
Correct. I'm not making findings in this case. I mean, I don't think Rule 202 is an evidentiary hearing. I assume for the sake of argument that everything you say is true. I assume that. So assuming that, you know, the question is, to me, it's not about the underlying merits, it's about jurisdiction, it's about arbitration, it's about whether or not the benefit outweighs the burden.
Understood, Your Honor. I appreciate that, Your Honor. Can I ask one last question for clarification?
Mike,
our opposing counsel filed today while we were on airplanes objections to our evidence. And if the court is inclined to take those up, I would like to a chance to address those. Or if you're just going to deny them based on your legal rulings, that's fine too. But we haven't had a chance to address those, and we don't think the objections are valid.
Right. I look at the four corners of the original petition. I mean, this is, unless there were some sort of operative facts, for example, like maybe there's a venue issue or something, maybe you could establish venue, or was it, you know, the court would need to supplement, and you could add that in for some reason. I don't think that there's really any harm in that. I think getting off into the merits of whether or not you have a case, whether it's doping or not, that doesn't really matter. I mean, as far as it's about whether or not, you know, the court wants to get involved in this kind of, I think this is a proper use of